I want to continue talking about the Christian's relationship to the Old Testament. Now, last time, if you remember, we covered extensively how the Old Testament is abolished, it's done away, it was nailed to the cross, taken away, vanished away, and I think I thoroughly proved that. So, but I did mention the last time that there's that verse in Hebrews 8 and verse 13, which says, "Now that which is old, that which decayeth and waxeth away is that which is." How's it say it now? I already forgot. That which, I'm going to have to read it now. Hate it when that happens. Should have been our memory verse this week, I guess. Hebrews 8 and verse 13. "In that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away." It was right on the tip of my tongue. So anyway, we see there the idea that it's decaying and waxing old as Paul is writing this in the book of Hebrews. So there's a sense in which the Old Testament was legally and finally and completely abolished whenever Christ died on the cross and he put it away. But then there's a practical transitional period there where it was decaying and waxing old. And this is what I want to talk about this morning. This is the first thing that I want to talk about anyway. If you remember the history of Israel, so 33 AD was whenever Christ was crucified, somewhere around there. And then, but the Jewish temple stood until 70 AD, so almost 40 years. The Jews could kind of still act like Jews, whether they be unbelieving Jews, like the Pharisees, or believing Jews, the Christians. They could all still kind of practice their Jewishness. And they could go, I mean, there were sacrifices offered in the temple daily. And as I will show you here in a minute, even Christians met in the temple daily back in those days. So, and there's a couple, well, I don't want to get ahead of myself. So first of all, let me just go back and just give you just a few verses to establish that Christ officially and legally abolished the law of Moses, just to refresh your memory. If you turn to the Colossians, the book of Colossians 2 and verse 14, Colossians 2:14 says, "Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross." In verse 16, "Let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink or in respect of an holy day or of the new moon or of the Sabbath days." So this says that Christ blotted out and took out of the way the handwriting of ordinances which was against us. Now when you compare that with Ephesians 2:15, Paul talking about the same thing here, he says, he uses the word abolished. In Ephesians 2:15 says, "Having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances, for to make in himself of twain one new man, so making peace." So he took it out of the way, he abolished it, and lest you think it's only referring to the ceremonial law, Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 3, as you remember from last week, that it was the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, written and graven in stone, which were also taken away. 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 13 says, "And not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished." And as we saw last time, he was talking about when Moses came down off of Mount Sinai with his face shining and he put the veil over his face, he was carrying the Ten Commandments written and graven in stones. And Paul says that is what was abolished. Now think about this. This is an important point. The New Testament, which declared that the law was abolished, was not written for another 20 to 30 years after Christ died on the cross. So how much revelation was given to the apostles between the time that it was that Christ died and that it was written down, we don't really know. I mean, maybe it was given to him, maybe it wasn't. And if it was given to him, it would have been at that point by word of mouth. So they didn't have what we have right here. They didn't have 2 Corinthians 3:13 yet. Paul didn't write these things until the 50s and the 60s AD, so 20 to 30 years later. So if you think about yourself being a Jew back then, you got the Old Testament law of Moses, and this is how you've always done things. And now you see Christ came, and you see that he fulfilled it, and we know that he fulfilled the types and shadows, and he was that Passover lamb and so on. But you really don't, you don't have a verse that says, oh, that thing's done away, taken away, and you don't have to keep any of that stuff anymore. So it makes sense why the Jews would maybe continue to still keep some of those things until the law was written down in the New Testament. And this kind of explains why you see some things happening in the New Testament that you do, one of which we will talk about today with Paul going into the temple and making himself chargeable to some people that were had the oath of a Nazarite on them and so on, which was all part of the law of Moses, which is technically put away, but yet Paul still kept it. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. So while the temple still stood, Christians could meet in it for worship even. It wasn't like the temple was some evil abomination now which you had to stay away from. It was still holy. I mean, there was nothing wrong with it. But the sacrifices, and specifically the sacrifices for sins, should not have been offered anymore. They probably were, I'm assuming, because the unbelieving Jews didn't believe that Jesus Christ was the end of the law for righteousness. But those sacrifices shouldn't have been happening. But the temple itself was still holy. It was a pattern of the thing, the true temple, which was in heaven. Let me just give you a couple of verses here, which shows that the New Testament church would meet in the temple. This is while they still had favor with the people. Eventually, they lost favor with the people and started getting beaten, those kind of things. But for a while there, they were kind of in tight with the crowd. In Acts 2 and verse 46, this is in the very beginning, on the day of Pentecost. And it says, "And they continued daily with one accord in the temple, breaking bread from house to house," and breaking bread from house to house, "did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart." So this was before the thing really started to get wildly popular, and there were thousands of Jews all over the place being converted, and then the envy and the jealousy of the Pharisees kicked in. But right in the very beginning, they were able to freely meet in the temple and have communion services there. Look in Acts 3 and verse 1. It says, "Now Peter and John went up together into the temple at the hour of prayer, being the ninth hour. And a certain man lame from his mother's womb was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms of them that entered into the temple." So, I mean, you think about it, this is only 50 days after Christ was risen from the dead. Christ rose from the dead. He hung around for about 40 days. Not 40 days. He hung around for 40 days. And then there were 10 more days, and then the day of Pentecost happens. And we know that because the day of Pentecost was 50 days after the Passover, and Christ was killed at the Passover. So anyway, this is not a very long time after Jesus went to heaven. And they certainly didn't have the epistles, and who knows how much understanding. I mean, at this point, the Holy Spirit had just been sent to them to bring all things to their remembrance. So it makes sense that they're still doing Jewish things, because they haven't really been told yet at that point. Look at Acts 5, 19 through 21. Acts 5, 19 through 21 says, "But the angel of the Lord by night opened the prison doors." This is when Peter was put in prison. "Opened the prison doors and said, and brought them forth and said, 'Go stand and speak in the temple to the people all the words of this life.' And when they had heard that, they entered into the temple early in the morning and taught. But the high priest came, and they that were with him, and called the council together and all the senate of the children of Israel, and sent to the prison to have them brought out." And they find out, oh, they're not there, and they're in the temple teaching. They weren't very happy about that. Look in Acts 5 and verse 42. "And daily in the temple and in every house they ceased not to teach and preach Jesus Christ." This is after they'd straitly charged them, beaten them, and everything else, and they still continue to go back into the temple. As we talked about on Wednesday, they were disobeying the government authorities there, because, as Peter says, we ought to obey God rather than men. In verse 29, Acts 5, 29, "Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, 'We ought to obey God rather than men.'" So during that time, there were believing Jews who were still zealous of the law. Look in Acts 21 and verse 20. Now when this is talking about, when James says that they're zealous of the law, he's not talking about these Pharisees, unbelieving Pharisees. He's talking about Christians, Jewish Christians, but they still had a zeal for the law. Probably because, they just didn't know better at the time yet. Acts 21 and verse 20. It says, "And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, 'Seest thou, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe.'" What they heard of was Paul declaring all that God had wrought among the Gentiles by his ministry. And I think it's funny there, maybe nothing to really consider, but it's funny, they heard it, they glorified the Lord, word of the Lord, and then they have to one-up them. "Look here, brother, how many thousands of Jews we got. Oh, you got a few Gentiles over there. Look at all the thousands of Jews I got under my ministry." I don't know if there's any kind of comparing going on there or not, but kind of interesting. It was still lawful for believing Jews to keep parts of the law while the temple still stood in this transitional period. So there were still parts of it that they could keep. And I'm going to give you an example of this in the Apostle Paul, which I already made reference to. So though Paul was no longer in the Jews' religion, he was still a Jew. right? And he makes that very clear. He was no longer the Jews' religion. That religion at one time was very acceptable with God. By the time that Jesus came around, the Pharisees had perverted it so much that it hardly looked like God's religion at all. And Jesus was reforming that whole corrupt system. Look in Galatians 1, 13 through 16. So don't ever use the phrase Judeo-Christian ethics or whatever to me. I don't want to hear that nonsense. There's no such thing as Judeo-Christian. There's Christian. This Judeo stuff is Pharisee stuff. It's Talmudic nonsense. So anyway, Galatians 1, 13 through 16. Paul says, "For ye have heard of my conversation in time past in the Jews' religion." See, he doesn't say in my religion, in the Jews' religion. He specifies that's their religion, not mine. "How that beyond measure I persecuted the church of God," that's God's religion, "and wasted it, and profited in the Jews' religion above many my equals in mine own nation, being more exceedingly zealous of the traditions of my fathers." How far was I going to read? Yeah, 16. "But when it pleased God, who separated me from my mother's womb and called me by his grace to reveal his son in me, that I might preach among him, or among the Gentile, I'm sorry, that I might preach him among the heathen, immediately I conferred not with flesh and blood." It didn't take Paul but a New York second to get out of that Jew's religion and get into Jesus Christ religion whenever he was converted on the road to Damascus that day. But even though he had forsaken the Jews' religion, he says in another place, "We have renounced the hidden things of dishonesty." Wish I could find that for you. I think it's in 2 Corinthians, but I don't want to go show you how poor of a Bible student I am when I can't find it. But anyway, you know the verse I'm talking about. We have renounced the hidden things of dishonesty. There's a difference between renouncing and denouncing. Denouncing is just condemning somebody else for doing it. Renouncing is when you did it yourself and now you have put that away from yourself. Paul says, "We have renounced." So he used to be involved in hidden things of dishonesty in that Jews' religion. It wasn't exactly a godly religion at that point. But Paul was still a Jew, nonetheless. Look in Acts 22 and verse 3. And he still had a heart for the Jewish people. He said in Romans 9 that his heart's desire and prayer to God to Israel was that they might be saved. He said that he could wish himself accursed from Christ for his brethren according to the flesh. So he loved the Jewish people still. In Acts 22 and verse 3, he says, I am verily a man, which am a Jew, born in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, yet brought up in this city, that is Jerusalem, at the feet of Gamaliel, and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers, and was zealous toward God, as ye all are this day. So he unapologetically says, "I am a Jew." He didn't try to shy away from being a Jew, but he was not in the Jewish religion anymore. Now, being a Jew by nationality and lineage, Paul could still be a Jew, or still be as a Jew, to the degree and the extent that he was not compromising on his Christianity. So he could be, in the word I want to emphasize there, he could be as a Jew. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 20. So Paul, when he could be, he was all things to all men. And if you remember, we did a Bible study, short little series on that, I don't know when, maybe a year or two ago, I can't remember. Couldn't have been two, I haven't been here quite that long. But anyway, a year or so ago, called all things to all men. And this is one of the things that he was all things to, were the Jews. It's pretty easy for him to be all things to the Jews because he used to be one. He knew exactly what they were like. He could mix in there like a chameleon. Although, I just told you the other day, chameleons actually don't change their skin to match their backgrounds. They change it because of what kind of mood they're in or if they're scared or something. Something I learned in the general book of ignorance. But anyway, that really has nothing to do with anything, but I thought I would share that with you so you learned something new today. All right, so 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 20. "And unto the Jews I became as a Jew." I didn't become a Jew, but I became as a Jew, "that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law," that's the Jews, "as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law, as without law." See, he became as a Gentile to the Gentiles as well. They didn't have the law of God. So he goes there and sits down with a, you know, BLT sandwich with them and talks to them like he's a Gentile. So he was the most Jew and Jew you could Jew with, but then he was also the apostle of the Gentiles. So he truly was a very diverse man. So here's one example, probably the best example that I can think of Paul being as a Jew to the Jews. Paul went into the synagogue of the Jews on many occasions. Okay, I got ahead of myself. Pardon me. I'll get to that point in just a second. Paul went into the synagogue of the Jews many times, though, and he used that as a platform to preach Christianity. And if you think about how God set the thing up, and I mean, in the mind of God, we would have had no idea what was going on, but you go way back, and the Jews had been dispersed into the lands a couple different times, but especially under Nebuchadnezzar, whenever he took them over, and God told them that if they didn't keep his law, and we read about that in this study, in this series, that they would be dispersed over all the nations of the earth. Well, come the time of the first century, the Jews were dispersed all over the place. You had Jews, you had synagogues in all these foreign lands, all the countries of Asia. So whenever when Jesus tells Paul and the other apostles to go into all the earth, preach the gospel to every creature, go into all nations, they could just go into a new town, a new city, a new country, and there would be a Jewish synagogue there. So they automatically had a platform. They could go right to there because the gospel was supposed to be to the Jew first anyway. They go to the synagogue and preach the gospel. So let's go. Let's look at a couple examples of that in Acts 13, 14 through 16. Not dissimilar, sort of, to the opportunity that Pastor Mott had in the Philippines. You know, a lot of primitive Baptists went over there and did a lot of work, and they started a lot of churches over there. And then he goes over there, and kind of like going into the synagogues of the Jews in Paul's day, he goes into the churches of the primitive Baptists and preaches the truth.
That's right.
You know, so it was a platform for him. So, you know, maybe we can do the same thing, only we're not very well received if you go into Arminian Baptist churches or something and try to use that as a platform, but you never know. Acts 13, 14 through 16. It says, but when they departed from Perga, they came into Antioch in Pisidia and went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. And after the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogues sent unto them, saying, ye men and brethren, if ye have any word of exhortation for the people, say on. And Paul stood up and beckoning with his hand, said, men of Israel, and ye that fear God, give audience. Then I've said this before, and I'll say it again, I beg God for this opportunity. Every time, if I happen to be visiting another church for some reason, I visited the church up the road here a couple times on a Sunday evening, and I always thought, maybe the pastor won't be there, or because he knows I'm a pastor, or maybe he'd say, oh, Pastor Wagner, you have anything to say, say on. Oh, sure, I sure do. Let me get up here. Let me talk about sovereign grace for a minute or two. But so anyway, it's never happened, but it would be a neat opportunity. Acts 14 and verse 1. And it came to pass in Iconium that they went both together into the synagogue of the Jews, and so spake that a great multitude, both of the Jews and also of the Greeks, believed. Once again, here's a platform for the Jews and the Gentiles in the synagogue there. Acts 17, 1 through 2. Now you'll have people, they'll use verses like this where Paul went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day. That means we're supposed to keep the Sabbath. No, it doesn't. No more than it would mean if I went down to a Seventh-day Adventist church here or something and on the Sabbath day just to hear what they had to say or something. That doesn't mean that I have to keep. It doesn't mean I am keeping the Sabbath, and it doesn't mean that I have to keep the Sabbath just because some other religion does it. Acts 17, 10 through 11. Did I read verses 1 through 2 yet? I don't think I did. Acts 17, 1 through 2, first of all. And when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures. Jump down to verses 10 and 11. And the brethren immediately sent away Paul and Silas by night unto Berea. This is after the Jews stirred people up in Thessalonica, so they had to flee out of there by night. It says, who coming thither went into the synagogue of the Jews? These were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the Scriptures daily whether those things were so. So you just see over and over again in the book of Acts, every time Paul goes into a city, he goes into the synagogue of the Jews first. Gospels to the Jew first, and then to the Gentile. One more, Acts 18, verse 4, and then 7 and 8. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. Verse 7. And he departed thence and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that worshipped God, whose house was joined hard to the synagogue. And Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his house. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. So most of these New Testament churches that Paul started originated by him going to the synagogue, preaching to the Jews, and the Gentiles were also there to hear the law. And that's how most of these churches were started. Churches in Antioch and in Corinth and Thessalonica and so on. All those churches were started as an evangelistic effort that was based in the synagogues. Paul would even have Timothy become as a Jew to gain the Jews. He didn't have Timothy become a Jew, but he had him become as a Jew. Look in Acts 16, 1 through 3. So during this time, there were some things that you could do to placate the Jews a bit, to try to, you know, win them over. And this is one time that Paul gave in. Acts 16, 1 through 3. Then came he to Derbe and Lystra, and behold, a certain disciple was there named Timotheus, the son of a certain woman, which was a Jewess, and believed, but his father was a Greek, which was well reported of by the brethren that were in Lystra and Iconium. Him would Paul have to go forth with him, and took and circumcised him because of the Jews which were in those quarters, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. I'm going to talk about this in the objection section, because people will try to use this verse to say, see, the circumcision was still binding on New Testament Christians because Paul circumcised Timothy. That is a terrible argument. If they knew their Bible, they wouldn't make it because he didn't circumcise Titus. So what is he? He's keeping the law of God here and sinning in another place? It doesn't make any sense at all. He did it because of the Jews. He didn't do it because of the law of God. So I just kind of gave away the objection. But anyway, he did it to placate the Jews. So Timothy became as a Jew. Kind of a painful experience for him, but he became as a Jew so that he could win the Jews. Paul even went so far as to go into the temple with some believing Jews that had taken a vow on them, the vow of a Nazarite. He went in there to be at charges with them and to purify himself in the temple. And an offering was made for every one of them, it says, including Paul. So let's go to Acts 21, 18 through 26. Acts 21, 18 through 26. Some people take the position, which I do not, but I'd never even heard this, and I was reading somewhere, I forget where it was. Some people take the position that basically Paul compromised here. He kind of just, he folded under the pressure, and he went in there and he did what he shouldn't have done. And I don't take that position. I mean, I don't see Paul being condemned for doing this. I don't see Peter rebuking him to the face, you know, when he heard that he went into the temple or something like that. I don't think he did anything wrong. I think he was within the limits of what he was allowed to do under the law of God at that time. Acts 21, 18 through 26. And the day following, Paul went in with us unto James. James was the presiding elder at the church of Jerusalem. And all the elders were present. And when he had saluted them, he declared particularly what things God had wrought among the Gentiles by his ministry. You ever go out and you ever witness to somebody and you come back and you tell the story, oh, and they said this and then I said that and here's what I told them and da-da-da-da-da. That's biblical. That's exactly what Paul's doing. He was declaring particularly. He was giving them the nitty-gritty detail of the conversion of the Gentiles. I'm sure he had imagined his stories. Right? These philosophers on Mars Hill came up to me and they said, what will this babbler say? And I said, look here, you look at that tomb of the unknown God or that, you know, thing of the unknown God and here's who he really is. And it would have been neat to hear Paul tell the whole story. You would have saw those philosophers fold underneath the gospel. They didn't have anything to say about that or who knows what. I'm making it all up. But anyway, Acts 21, where was I at? Verse 20. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, seest thou, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they are all zealous of the law. And they are informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither walk after the customs. What is it therefore? The multitude must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come. Do therefore this, that we say to thee, we have four men which have a vow on them. Take that, or them take. And purify thyself with them, and be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law. As touching the Gentiles which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing, save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols, and from blood, and from strangled, and from fornication. Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification, until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. So basically, the gist of the thing was here, James says that there are Jews here that are zealous of the law. They have heard these rumors that you're going and you're teaching the Jews among the Gentiles that the Jews ought to forsake the law of Moses, not keep any of it, not circumcise their kids or anything. And they say, we want to know what it is. Is this true or is this not true? And here's what you do. We got these Jews here. They've taken the vow of a Nazarite, which I'm interpreting that because of the shaving of the head and everything makes sense. It matches the vow of a Nazarite. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But take these guys, go into the temple with them, be at charges with them, and go through that whole ceremony with them and show everybody that you do walk orderly and you still keep the law. That's what they wanted him to do. And he did it, and an offering was made for them. So I take from that that at that time, he, as a Jew, and when the Old Testament is decaying, waxing old, ready to vanish away, he could still keep parts of that law because the temple still stood and so on, and part of the Jewish religion could still be kept. So let's dig into this a little bit at a time. So these were believing Jews, as we saw. They were still zealous of the law, verse 20. This was during that transitional period in the New Testament, or when the New Testament was in effect, but the Old Testament was technically abolished, as we saw in 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 13, when it says that which is abolished, talking about the law of Moses. But while the temple still stood, it was practically decaying, as that verse in Hebrews tells us, Hebrews 8 and verse 13. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. So in a practical way, it is decaying and waxing old, and it's still kind of in use. But technically, they wouldn't have had to have kept any of it, right? They could have just put it away at that point and not kept any of that thing. Right. But there was that transitional period where they could do that. So during that time, the Jews could still make non-sin offerings, but they couldn't make sin offerings because Jesus Christ was the sin offering. He was the final sin offering, and there would be no more offering for sin after him. Now, I am extrapolating this point that they couldn't make sin offerings because of this verse that I'm going to read you in the book of Hebrews. So turn to Hebrews 10, 8 through 14. This is what you call comparing spiritual things with spiritual. This is what you call there's no contradiction in the Bible. So we're using the law of Bible study, the rules of Bible study here, to figure out that they could not make sin offerings in the temple. Now, I'm sure that they did, because a lot of those Jews were unbelieving. The Levites that were doing the sacrifices were still unbelievers at the time. They didn't believe that Jesus was the ultimate sacrifice for sin. But according to God's law at this point, no more sacrifice for sin. Hebrews 10, 8 through 14. It says, above when he said, sacrifices and offering and burnt offerings and offering for sin, thou wouldest not. Neither hadst pleasure therein, which are offered by the law. Then said he, lo, I come to do thy will, O God. He taketh away the first, that's that old covenant, that he may establish the second, the New Testament. By the which will we are sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. This is only going to happen one time. And every priest standeth daily ministering and offering oftentimes the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. They were never effectual anyway, and they definitely needed to cease to be offered once Christ made his one all-sufficient sacrifice. Verse 12, but this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down on the right hand of God, from henceforth expecting till his enemies be made his footstool, for by one offering he hath perfected forever them that are sanctified. One offering he hath perfected. Not that he made some perfection possible for you. He hath perfected. That's a present perfect completed verb tense. When he made that offering, that was it. He entered into the holy place having obtained eternal redemption for us. It was a done deal. So, from that I take that there could be lawfully no more sacrifices for sin made in the temple. So I do not believe that Paul would have gone into the temple and had a sacrifice for sin made for him. I do not believe that that would have happened because Paul knew, he wrote the book of Hebrews, there remaineth no more sacrifice for sins. Christ's all-sufficient sacrifice was it. So there had been rumors floating around that Paul was teaching the Jews that they were supposed to forsake the law of Moses and not circumcise their children and so on. We read about that in verse 21. So like I said, there were four Jews. Apparently they had taken a vow of a Nazarite there in verses 23 and 24. Now this vow required them to shave their heads. So this is why I say it was the vow of a Nazarite. So go back to Numbers 6, and we're going to read a little bit about the vow of a Nazarite here, and we'll see that it pretty well matches up with what appeared to be going on there in Acts 21. In Numbers 6, 2:5, 18 and 20. Numbers 6, in verse 2. It says, "Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Lord." So here's the vow of the Nazarite, and look what it entails in verse 5. It says, "All the days of the vow of his separation there shall no razor come upon his head until the days be fulfilled in the which he separateth himself unto the Lord. He shall be holy and shall let the locks of his hair grow, let the locks of the hair of his head grow." So there is this place there in Acts 21 when these men, after they went into the temple, that they would shave their heads, James said. There was another place, don't remember where it was, in the book of Acts anyway, where it says that Paul had shaven his head because he had a vow. So it sounds like he had made a vow of a Nazarite or something similar to that anyway. Verses 18 and 20 of Numbers 6. It says, "And the Nazarite shall shave the head of his separation at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and shall take the hair of the head of his separation and put it in the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offerings. And the priest shall take the sodden shoulder of the ram and one unleavened cake out of the basket and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them upon the hands of the Nazarite after the hair of his separation is shaven. And the priest shall wave for them a wave offering before the Lord that is holy for the priest, with the wave breast and heave shoulder. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine." So just go back there. You might want to keep your, you might want to keep your finger in number 6 if you want, but it'll be a little bit until we get back there. So go ahead and go back to Acts 21, verses 23 and 24, and see if this doesn't sound like what we just read there about the vow of a Nazarite. Acts 21, verses 23 through 24. James says, "Do therefore this, that we say to thee, we have four men which have a vow on them. Take them and purify thyself with them, and be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that thou thyself walkest orderly and keepest the law." And then in verse 26, it says that they went into the temple, and to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification, until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. So it sounds pretty much like we read about number 6. You know, you let your hair of your head grow, then you go and you purify yourself, then you go into the temple, and an offering is made for you. And then you shave the head, and then an offering is made for you. So it sounds pretty much like what was going on there in Acts 21. So James had asked Paul to go there and be at charges with him so that he can show that he was a Jew that walked orderly. In other words, Paul was keeping number 6. That's what James wants you to show, that, hey, you're still a Jew, you're still keeping the law. So Paul did purify himself with them, as we saw, and he entered into the temple, and an offering was made for every one of them. So it wasn't just these other guys, but it says every one of them, speaking of Paul with them. In verse 26, until that an offering, last part of the verse, until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. So I take from the language of that text that an offering was made for Paul too. And that would have been okay, as long as it wasn't an offering for sin. There were many different offerings back in the Old Testament. Wave offerings and sheaf offerings and drink offerings and meat offerings and shoulder, heave shoulder and all that kind of thing. So there were plenty of offerings that could have been offered that were not sin offerings. So let's go back to number 6, 13 and 14. And just to show you that, because somebody may say, oh, but there were sin offerings offered when a vow of a Nazarite was taken. And this is why I said that this was probably a modified version of that. And like I said, I mean, this is an extrapolation, but when it says there's no more offering for sin, when Christ was the one all-sufficient sacrifice, I don't see Paul going into the temple and having an offering for sin made for him. I don't see that happening. So in number 6, verses 13 and 14. It says, "And this is the law of the Nazarite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, he shall be brought unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and he shall offer his offering unto the Lord, one he lamb of the first year without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb of the first year without blemish for a sin offering, and one ram without blemish for peace offerings." See right there in that verse, you see that there's burnt offerings and peace offerings. They're not all sin offerings. Look at verses 14 through 17. See some other offerings here. Oh, we already read verse 14. Let's read 15 through 17. In the basket of unleavened bread, cakes of fine flour mingled with oil, and wafers of unleavened bread anointed with oil, and their meat offering, and their drink offerings. Now remember, meat in the King James Bible almost always, if not always, refers to just food in general. So when it talks about bread, bread is considered meat in the Old Testament. When it's talking about meat as we think about it today, it would say flesh. But when it says meat, a lot of times it's just talking about bread or wafers or something like that. Verse 18. We already read verse 18 before. Okay, and one more. Verse 20. "And the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. This is holy for the priest, with the wave breast and the heave shoulder, that and after that the Nazarite may drink wine." So this is what was going on there. I assume that priest was making one of the peace offerings or the wave offering or some other offering besides an offering for sin. So since Paul was still a Jew, he could keep part of that ceremonial law and he could become as a Jew to gain the Jews, 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 20. Now, once Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed in 70 AD, it was not possible to keep the ceremonial law of Moses anymore. So you can't truly be a Jew. I mean, you cannot practice the religion of the Old Testament today. There is no Judaism, if you want to use that term, without the temple. Without the temple, you cannot practice the law of God as it was given by Moses. So for the last 2,000 years, there has been no Jewish religion. I mean, there's something that they call a Jewish religion, and they've, you know, modified it, I guess, so they can keep it as best they can, but I think God has intentionally kept that temple cast down so that they cannot do that religion anymore. It's not an option. Now, by this time, by the time that this is happening here, the New Testament was complete or very near completion, and the apostles and other Christians knew that the Old Testament was indeed abolished and done away with. Okay, so finally, to the part we've all been waiting for. What parts of the Old Testament are still binding on New Testament Christians today? So that's really the whole purpose of this study. So I don't know how far I'm going to get into this. We'll see. But I at least want to get into some of the Ten Commandments. So before we go to the parts of the law that are kept by us today, I do want to make a distinction of the fallacy between the moral law and the ceremonial law, because a lot of people will make this distinction that the ceremonial law was put away. That was what was nailed to the cross, but it wasn't the moral law. But you look through the Bible, and you're never going to find the law broken up into ceremonial law and moral law. Those are just constructs of men that have come up with these titles and these terms. And terms are okay, and we use terms too, right? Sovereign grace, eternal son. We don't use eternal sonship, but we use terms to talk about various doctrines. And the terms themselves are not, in the Bible. But that's okay. But the thing is, when the concept is not in the Bible, that's when it's a problem. Right. And there is no moral law, ceremonial law distinction in the Bible. But they will allege here that a couple of verses are used to back up this point. In Acts 4, 13 through 14, not Acts, Deuteronomy 4, 13 through 14. This one is used to show that there were two different parts of the law of Moses, like there's just this major division between them or something, where they were two entirely different things. Deuteronomy 4, 13 through 14 says, "And he declared unto his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even 10 commandments, which he wrote upon the tables of stone. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that ye might do them in the land whither ye go over to possess it. So they take from that verse and they say, see, there's the moral law in verse 13, the Ten Commandments, and there's the ceremonial law that the Lord commanded Moses to teach them the statutes and judgments. So that's the moral and the ceremonial law. It doesn't really say that at all. It's just simply talking about God gave them the Ten Commandments and he told them to go teach the judgments and the statutes that he gave them. I mean, you really have to bring something out of there that's not there to make that point. The other verse that they use is 2 Kings 21 and verse 8. And I can thank my enemies for a lot of these verses that I have here because the guy that sent it to me is not my enemy, but he was sending me, he said, if you want to get the other side of this whole Sabbath debate thing, go listen to a guy named Doug Batchelor. He's, I guess, a very popular Seventh-day Adventist preacher. I don't know. So I watched his sermon on YouTube, and this is where I got some of this information from, some of the arguments and the objections that I'll be covering and were from his sermon. I guess I was told that this is pretty much, meaning you want to get the opposition's view, this is it. So I don't know. We'll see. But I do believe these two verses I got from him, if I remember right. But 2 Kings 21 and verse 8. Sometimes the best ammunition against a false position is the defense of that position by the heretic. They just, if it proves anything, it proves too much. And so, anyway, I've been doing a study on the sonship of Christ too, which I'll do for you sometime anyway. The outline's done, so one of these days we'll do that one too. And the best argument against eternal sonship is the arguments made for eternal sonship by the opponents. That's the best arguments for them, against them. All right, 2 Kings 21 and verse 8. It says, neither will I make the feet of Israel move any more out of the land which I gave their fathers, only if they will observe to do according to all that I have commanded them and according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded them. Okay, so from that, all that I commanded them was the moral law, supposedly, Ten Commandments. And all that my servant Moses commanded them was the ceremonial law. That's what they say. Which, yeah, so you go figure. Try to build a doctrine off of a verse like that and say that there's two different laws or something like that. It's absurd. Okay, so the Ten Commandments, though, so this is the refutation of it. Even if there was a distinction in the Bible between the moral law and the ceremonial law, the Bible says that they're both abolished anyway. So it doesn't even matter. Even if you want to make the distinction, and you could legitimately, it's a moot point anyway. They're both abolished. The Ten Commandments are referred to as the Law of Moses. Look at Mark 7 and verse 10. This is review. We covered this last week. Mark 7. In verse 10. It says, and Moses said, you remember what God says there about the Ten Commandments, that God said, God wrote them. But here, Jesus said, and I think he kind of knows something. He said, for Moses said, honor thy father and thy mother, and whoso curseth father or mother, let him die the death. The interesting thing is, the second part of that verse, whoso curseth father or mother, let him die the death, is from Exodus 21:17. So that is not part of the Ten Commandments. Right. The honor your father and mother, honor thy father and mother, is the Ten Commandments. So right there it says Moses said both of them. He said the Ten Commandments and he said the other statutes and judgments. You can see that in Exodus 20 and verse 12, and that's the verse that Paul is quoting there with honor thy father and thy mother. But 2 Corinthians 3:15 tells us that that's abolished. Look here. Well, first of all, 2 Corinthians 3:15 tells us that when it says Moses, it's referring to the Ten Commandments, and then some other verses tell us it's abolished. He says there in 2 Corinthians 3:15, but even unto this day, when Moses is read, the veil is upon their heart. Moses is read. And what is he talking about in 2 Corinthians 3, which we've been over several times now? He's talking about what was written and engraven in stones, the Ten Commandments when he came down off of Mount Sinai. And he said, when Moses is read. So Moses is the Ten Commandments. And that is abolished. Look at verses 7, 11, and 13. It says, but if the ministration of death written engraven in stones was glorious so that the children of Israel could not steadfastly behold the face of Moses, for the glory of his countenance, which glory was to be done away. So there he says it was to be done away. And then you got a verse that says it is done away. Verse 11. For if that which is done away was glorious, much more that which remaineth is glorious. He's talking about the glory of the Old Testament versus the glory of the New Testament. Old Testament was glorious. It's done away. The New Testament far exceeds in glory. And one more, verse 13. And not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished. All right, so I know I've been over these points before, but I wanted to hammer it one more time. They are abolished. And we already looked at Colossians 2, 14 through 17 already, where it says that it was nailed to the cross. It was done away with. So both of which, and let's go to that Colossians verse as a matter of fact. So there we see in 2 Corinthians 3 that the Ten Commandments written in stone were abolished. Well then, let's look at the ceremonial law too, if you want to call it that. Colossians 2 in verse 14, he says, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances which was against us, or that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. And what is he talking about there? Verse 16, let no man therefore judge you in respect, or judge you in meat, or in drink, or in respect of an holy day, or of the new moon, or of the Sabbath days. That's the ceremonial law type of stuff. Meat, drink, holy days, new moons, Sabbaths, that's ceremonial type stuff. So ceremonial and the law, and the Ten Commandments are all done away with by the cross of Christ. Now, furthermore, the moral law was not limited to the Ten Commandments because there were moral laws, quote unquote, that were given outside of the Ten Commandments. And I'll just give you a couple examples. Fornication and sodomy. Look at Deuteronomy 22, 21. So you can't just say that the Ten Commandments is the moral law because there were lots of moral law, unless you don't consider sodomy and fornication immoral. I don't know. I mean, I consider those immoral. I would say that would be part of the moral law. Look in Deuteronomy 22 and verse 21. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 21 says that then they shall bring out the damsel to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her with stones that she die, because she hath wrought folly in Israel to play the whore in her father's house. So shalt thou put evil away from among you. So here a fornicating woman was to be stoned. If she got married and her husband found out that she wasn't a virgin, then she was supposed to be stoned. I would say that's part of the moral law. That is not in the Ten Commandments, in case you didn't know. How about sodomy? Look in Leviticus 18 and verse 22. Leviticus 18, 22. It says, thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination. God hates that filthiness. So that's clearly the moral law found in Moses' writings. These are the statutes and judgments that the Lord told Moses to teach the people. So it's not just ceremonial stuff. There were moral statutes in there as well. All right, so what parts of the Old Testament are we still under or are still binding on us today as New Testament Christians? Well, the first thing is, any commandment in the Old Testament that is repeated again in the New Testament is binding on New Testament Christians today. So that's going to be the first one. And this is going to be the major, the big one. So this is an obvious no-brainer. You find a commandment that was given in the Old Testament that is repeated in the New Testament, there's no argument that we are under that commandment today. The question, the thing would be, are we under it because it's in the New Testament, or are we under it because it's in the Old Testament? Well, we're under it because it's in the New Testament, and I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about here. All right. So since the Old Testament is abolished, the only commandments that still apply are the ones that are repeated again in the New Testament. Just think about it. I mean, if God has abolished the thing, that means it's done, it's put away with, it's ended, and so on. That means that we're not under any of it. But if you find laws repeated, you know that that's one of the laws that we're now under. So the fact that the Old and New Testaments are called testaments should tell us something about the parts of the Old Testament which are binding on Christians today. This is going to be a little bit of review, which we covered a week or two ago, but this is very important. So just the very fact that they're called testaments tell us, we should be able to reason from just what they're called to know that we are only under the parts of the Old Testament that are repeated in the New Testament. A testament is a formal declaration, usually in writing, of a person's wishes as to the disposal of his property after his death, a will. Okay, so if a person dies, or if a person writes a last will and testament, and then later writes a new last will and testament prior to his death, only the last testament or the new testament goes into effect at his death, right? Any previous testaments which he wrote are null and void when the last one is written. So, for instance, let's say you get married and you're newly married, you don't have any kids, and you write a last will and testament. And you say, if I die, I want to leave everything to my wife, and if my wife and I get killed together at the same time, or she dies before me, then I want to leave everything to my parents. Okay. That's your last will and testament. Very simple. You don't own, you're just newly married, you don't own much stuff anyway. So then, you know, along come kids down the road someday, and you think, I better update my last will and testament, right? I don't want my parents, they don't need the stuff anyway, and I want to make sure my kids get it. So so what you do is you take up, especially today, it's really easy. You pull up your Word document and you make a copy of it. So you got your Old Testament, you pull up there, right? And you start deleting stuff out of it. I don't need any of this stuff. But I don't want to reinvent the wheel. I don't want to rewrite the entire thing. So I'm going to use this as a base, as a template. And then you say, but I don't want to leave it to my parents anymore. So everything goes to my wife if I die, but if we both get killed together in a fiery car crash or something, then I want to leave it to my kids, right? So if you die, so let's say you die and your wife lives on after you. Well, when you die, which testament goes into effect? The first one or the second one? The second one, right? The second one goes into effect. So the fact that whenever you die, everything goes to your wife, didn't both testaments say that? Both testaments said everything goes to your wife when you die, right? Yeah. If she's still alive. But why did everything go to your wife? Because it was written in the new or because it was written in the old? Because it was written in the new. It doesn't matter that it was written in the old. That's fine, and you can go back to the old and see, it says it in both places, but it doesn't matter. That's not even a valid argument in court. It wouldn't matter anything. Just take that old thing, rip it up, and throw it away. It's of no value. Now, it's maybe of historical value, and the things were written in it or written for our admonition or something, you know, like to use biblical language, but it's of no force whatsoever. Right. Now, if your wife and you die at the same time, the things go to your kids. Now, your parents could not go back and say, ah, look, I live under the Old Testament. Right. This Old Testament here says everything goes to me. No, it doesn't. Everything goes to the kids because that's in the New Testament. You see, so it's the New Testament that goes into effect.
Unless the kids are bad.
And then you might, you know, maybe your kids are bad and you say, well, you know what? I want to leave everything to the pastor. And that would be your newest testament. You could do that. Just an idea. All right. So if the person, let me just make sure I got everything said that I wanted to say. If the person used his old will and testament as a starting point and decided to leave some of it as is and then proceeded to delete large portions of it and add in new things, only the parts of his old will and testament, which he carried over into the new will and testament, would be binding upon his death, but no parts which were not carried over into the new. Okay, so it's basically what I said. I just wanted to make sure I got it all. So it is with God's Old and New Testaments. It's the exact same way. Think about it as God just pulling up his Word document, copy and paste Old Testament in there, just start ripping stuff out, adding stuff in. Anything that he left in there is repeated in the New Testament, we're binding under. Why are we bound not to murder people? Is it because it was in the Old Covenant or in the New?
New.
Well, it's because it's in the New. It's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, the Old Testament's reinforcement of that or whatever, but you have to go with what it says in the New Testament. Now, only the parts of the Old Testament that are specifically carried over into the New Testament are binding on Christians today. After the death of Christ, the testator, so when he died, he put that New Testament into effect. Let's look at that verse one more time. We've looked at it in the weeks prior. Hebrews 9, 15 through 17. Hebrews 9, 15 through 17. It says, and for this cause, he is the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament, they which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. For where a testament is, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. For a testament is of force after men are dead. Otherwise, it is of no strength at all while the testator liveth. And think about this. Bud's funny example there, unless the kids are bad. Well, guess what? We're children of the New Testament. We are under the blood of the everlasting covenant. God has said in this New Testament, he's given us the promise of eternal life to his elect. What if we're bad? Does he write us out of the will? No, he can't write us out of the will. He wrote the will, he died under it, and the inheritance is ours whether we're good or bad. Now, he might spank you, he might chasten you, and I'm not certainly encouraging you to be bad boys and girls, but the fact that, you know, this idea that if you just fall out of faith, you know, at the end of your life or something, then you're going to go to hell. No, no, no. That was written in the New Testament, and Christ died under that New Testament, and that thing is in effect. your obedience notwithstanding. So, 9 of the 10 commandments are repeated again in the New Testament. But there's one that is, what's the word I was looking for? Anyway, I hate that when that happens. It's missing anyway, is the point that I was trying to say. I hate that when that happens. Anyway, there's one that's missing. But what I want to do is I want to go through all 10 commandments. We'll just go through them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and show you that they're repeated in the New Testament. Which one? Anyway, the ones that are. And there's going to be one that is missing. So let's look at the first commandment. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Turn back to Exodus 20 and verse 3. This would be good Bible study for you. I'm sure you've probably heard it said many times. I know you've heard me say it plenty of times, and you've probably heard it in the past, that 9 of the commandments are repeated in the New Testament. Well, it's good to know where they are and to have it, especially one of them, because one of them is a little bit tricky, and you have to look for it a little bit to find it. Look at Exodus 20 and verse 3. Exodus 20 and verse 3. Says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. So that one is repeated in the New Testament. If you look in 1 Corinthians 8, 4 through 6. 1 Corinthians 8, 4 through 6. Now, of course, if you ever tell anybody that the law of Moses is abolished, the first thing they're going to say is, what are you saying? We can kill and steal and commit adultery and all that kind of thing. Of course not. And that's just a stupid straw man argument or an emotional response, really. Of course we can't do that stuff because God's law says it in the New Testament as well. 1 Corinthians 8, verses 4 through 6. It says, as concerning, therefore, the eating of those things that are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that the idol is nothing in the world, and there is none other God but one. For Though there be that are called gods, whether in heaven or in earth, as there be gods many and lords many, but to us there is but one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we by him. So there is one God. And all these other things that are called gods are no gods at all. We're not supposed to be worshiping them. Look in Acts 14, 11 through 15. Paul was talking to some heathens here who thought that he was a god and thought that Barnabas was a god. They thought that they were Jupiter and Mercury. Acts 14, 11 through 15. It says, and when the people saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in the speech of Lycaonia, the gods are come down to us in the likeness of men. And they called Barnabas Jupiter and Paul Mercurius because he was the chief speaker. Then the priest of Jupiter, which was before their city, brought oxen and garlands unto the gates, and would have done sacrifice with the people, which when the apostles Barnabas and Saul heard of, they rent their clothes and ran in among the people, crying out and saying, sirs, why do ye these things? We also are men of like passions with you, and preach unto you that ye should turn from these vanities unto the living God, which made heaven and earth, and the sea, and all things that are therein. So when was the last time you saw the Pope, whenever he comes in his little Pope-mobile thing, and somebody comes in and tries to kiss his feet and worship him as a god, and he said, oh no, I'm a man of like passion as are you. Right. Yeah, right. He just takes the worship. Look at Matthew 4 and verse 10. Matthew 4 and verse 10. He's going to be the one bowing down one of these days, confessing that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Matthew 10 and verse 4, or 4 and verse 10, pardon me. Then said Jesus unto him that is under the devil, get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. There you have it, brought over into the New Testament. All right, the second commandment, no idols. Look back there in Exodus 20 again. Exodus 20, 4 through 6. Exodus 24 through 6. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself unto them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord, thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers unto the children, upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments." So the nice thing about the Old Testament is, if you notice that if you just look at the two Testaments, the Old Testament's got about almost four times as many pages in it. A lot more information in there. So when you find a commandment that's repeated in the New Testament, like, you know, little children, keep yourselves from idols, which we'll look at in just a second, then you go back there, oh, okay, idolatry is banned in the New Testament. Go back here and look at this nice expanded verse which tells us, all right, you want to know what idolatry is? Anything that's in heaven above, anything that's in the earth, anything that's under the earth, all that stuff. You don't make statues of anything. So it's kind of nice. Once you find a commandment, then you can go back and get more information back there in the Old Testament. It can be useful. And you can see applications of it in people's lives and what they did and how God judged them for it and so on. So the Old Testament is useful. But you just can't go back there and just pick a law that's not, there's no precedent for in the New Testament and start making up rules with it. You can't do that. So let's see that idols are, idol worship is forbidden in the New Testament. Look at 1 Corinthians 10, 7 and 14. 1 Corinthians 10, 7 and 14. Paul says, "Neither be ye idolaters as were some of them," talking about Israel in the wilderness. "As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." So remember what I said? You can get more information. Go back there. What's he talking about? The people rose up to eat and sat down to play? Or they sat down, probably got that backwards. They sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. What's he talking about? He's talking about whenever they made the golden calf on the foot of Mount Sinai. Aaron made a golden calf. Remember, well, Aaron didn't really make it. He just threw gold into the fire and a calf popped out. You know, so Aaron said anyway. But he made this golden calf, and he said, "Tomorrow's a feast to the Lord," capital L-O-R-D, Jehovah. So he was incorporating a pagan image there into the worship of Jehovah. So there you see, that's idolatry. So once again, you can take and you can learn back there from the Old Testament what God considers idolatry. So don't take pagan stuff and bring it into his religion. He doesn't like that. Verse 14, 1 Corinthians 10, 14. "Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry." I've said it before, I'll say it again. There are several things in the Bible that we're told to flee from. Idolatry, fornication, and riches. Or not riches, but the love of money. We're supposed to flee these things, Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6. So those things are such a stronghold, and they'll grab a hold of you so tightly that you're not going to be able to fight them. So you got to flee them. It's like if some big, huge dude's coming at you to wrestle. Don't try to fight them. Flee. You know, either shoot them or flee, one of the two. But don't try to fight them. You're not going to win. It's the same way with those type of sins. 1 John 5:21 says, "Little children, keep yourselves from idols." Last verse of the book. Let me go to that. Actually, you know what? There's a good point that can be made from there, from that. 1 John 5 and verse 21. Now you think, well, that's a strange way to end a you know, a book. Paul usually says the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with you or something. And why would he end it? "Little children, keep yourselves from idols." That's a strange way of ending it. Well, look at the verse previous to it, and this will tell us what idolatry is. Verse 20, "And we know that the Son of God is come and hath given us an understanding, that we may know him that is true, and we are in him that is true, even in his Son Jesus Christ. This is the true God and eternal life." Little children, keep yourselves from idols. Jesus Christ is the true God. Keep yourselves from idols. Anything that is not the Lord Jesus Christ is an idol. Amen. And that includes many things that go by the same name of the Lord Jesus Christ. They're not the true God. You've got to look at his works to figure out which is the right one. Acts 17 and verse 29. Acts 17, verse 29. Says, Paul says, "For as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art or man's device." It says back there in the book of Psalms, concerning idols, they that make them are like unto them. They're just as stupid, blind, dumb, and ignorant as the idols that they make. They're like unto them. All right, third commandment. Do I have time for the third commandment? I think I have time. This should probably be the last one because the fourth commandment's a biggie. So I'll leave you on a cliffhanger with that one. The third commandment is not taking the Lord's name in vain. Exodus 20 and verse 7. Exodus 20 and verse 7 says, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain." There's a steep penalty for that. God says you will not be held guiltless. God will hold you guilty when you take his name in vain. And I'm going to define what taking his name in vain is. And I know I've preached on this before, but you're going to hear it again because I think this is very important. Vain is an adverb, and when it's used in the phrase in vain, it means to no effect or purpose, ineffectually, useless, vainly. Now the next definition gets even closer. It is the phrase to take in vain. So when you take something in vain, that definition is to disregard or treat with contempt. Now, with name as the object. So here, now we're down to the brass tacks. To take a name in vain. What does that mean? It says, with name as the object, it's to use or utter the name of God, in parentheses, lightly, needlessly, or profanely. It's to mention or speak of casually or idly. So there you have it. The specific definition of taking a name, specifically God's name in vain, is to speak of it lightly, needlessly, carelessly, profanely, or casually, or idly. So it's not just when you say GD it, or when you blaspheme the name of God and say terrible things about him. Yeah, that would be taking it in vain. But it can be just using it idly, lightly, needlessly. And I've said it before, I'll say it again. You hear people all the time, and I don't want to hear any of you say it. When you say, "Oh God, oh my God," or "Oh, good Lord," or whatever. All that stuff is using the Lord's name in vain because you're using it casually, idly, needlessly. It's not necessary to say it. That's all using the Lord's name in vain. And you don't ever want to go there. The Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. And don't say, "Well, I'm a Christian. I can use the Lord's name. I have that right." You don't have the right to take the Lord's name in vain more than any heathen does. Who was Paul or who was Moses writing to in the Ten Commandments? He's writing to God's people, to Israel. They were the ones not to take the Lord's name in vain, not the heathen. I mean, the heathen shouldn't do it either, but this is talking to God's people here. So be really careful about that. And that's one thing that I really hate. I'd rather hear somebody dropping the F-bomb all day long than hear a JC come out of his mouth. Any day. Doesn't bother me at all. It's so funny. People, you're a preacher, and they think that you're going to be offended if you say the SH word or the F word or something. I'm not offended by that stuff. You say, "Oh God," I'm offended by that. That offends me. I don't want to hear the F-bomb coming out of your mouth every day or anything like that. But there is a time for strong language, and that's another sermon for another time. All right, so Jesus taught. Now, well, what I want you to, and in the outline I've underlined this, the definition of to take a name in vain is to use it profanely. Now, this will become important in just a minute. So Jesus taught that God's name is to be hallowed. Look in Matthew 6 and verse 9. So the question would be, okay, so we see, yeah, the Old Testament law or the Ten Commandments clearly says not to take the Lord's name in vain. Where's the New Testament counterpart? Where does it say, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain" in the New Testament? And this was one of Mr. Doug Batchelor's, that Seventh-day Adventist, this is one of his arguments. Because he gets the argument from people like us all the time that it's the commandments that are repeated in the New Testament and the Sabbath is not repeated in the New Testament, therefore we're not under the Sabbath. That's our argument. We use that all the time, right? And he'll say, he can't really refute it. I mean, if his position was true, he could say, "Look, book, chapter, and verse, it says keep the Sabbath." He can't do that. Right. So what he'll do is say, "Where does it say not to take the name of the Lord's name in vain in the New Testament?" And he thought he had me there for a while. And so I went and thought, well, that's a good question. I've said this a million times. Oh, they're all repeated in the New Testament except for the Sabbath. Where is that repeated? And I got thinking about it, got defining the terms, and sure enough, I found it. Now, I will give credit to where credit is due in Matthew 6, 9, this verse. I got that off of some website somewhere. I don't know. I forget where I saw that anyway. It was an excellent point. But the other ones were ones that I found through my own study. So in Matthew 6 and verse 9, and I'm sure this is nothing new. I'm sure this stuff's been preached a million times over again, so I'm not claiming that I have some new knowledge or something like that. Matthew 6 and verse 9, Jesus said, "After this manner, therefore, pray ye, our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." So to hallow means to make holy, to sanctify, purify, to honor as holy, to regard or treat with reverence, or awe, especially of God or his name. Now, it pretty much sounds to me like hallow and taking in vain are exact opposites. They're antonyms. Just take those definitions, and they're basically just mirror images of each other. They're completely opposite. So if Jesus says to hallow, that the Lord's name should be hallowed, what does that mean? It should not be unhallowed. And to unhallow is to take it in vain. The opposite of hallow is to take in vain. So that right there would do it enough. To hallow means to regard with reverence. To hallow God's name, which is to regard with reverence, is the opposite of taking it in vain, which is to disregard or treat with contempt. You see it? Regard with reverence, hallow. Disregard, to treat with contempt, is to take it in vain. They're exact opposites. So therefore, Jesus taught that we should not take the name of the Lord in vain. But I got another one for you. So using the Lord's name in vain is blasphemy, which is forbidden in the New Testament. So let me show you, first of all, that blasphemy is forbidden. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 2. And then I'll define some terms here and it'll be crystal clear. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 2. It says, "For men should be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy." Paul here is describing the last days when perilous times shall come. And these are people who are supposed to be turned away from in verse 5. These are clearly sins. Blasphemy is a sin. Colossians 3 and verse 8. Colossians 3 and verse 8. It says, "But now ye also put off all these, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication, out of your mouth." Now, blasphemy is profane speaking of God or sacred things, impious irreverence. Remember the definition of to take a name in vain was to use it profanely. Blasphemy is profane speaking of God. You see how these things are the same thing? Profane is an adjective, and it means not pertaining or devoted to what is sacred or biblical, especially in profane history, literature, unconsecrated, secular, lay, common, civil, as distinguished from ecclesiastical. The third definition, which specifically mentions taking God's name in vain, is characterized by disregard or contempt of sacred things, in later use by the taking of God's name in vain. Irreverent, blasphemous, ribald, impious, irreligious, wicked. So to speak blasphemy is profane speaking of God, and profane is taking the name, the Lord's name, in vain, by definition. So to blaspheme the Lord, to do blasphemy, is to take the Lord's name in vain. Now, let me show you how profane and vain speech are the same thing. Because remember, we're talking about taking the Lord's name in vain, and then we're talking about blasphemy, which is profane speech. So I want to show you that vain and profane are synonyms from the Bible. Look in 1 Timothy 2, or 6, in verse 20. 1 Timothy 6, in verse 20. This might be overkill, but you know me. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 20. "O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science, falsely so called." Profane and vain babblings. Words that are very similar, obviously. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 16. 2 Timothy 2:16, "But shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness." Paul tells Timothy several times to not pay attention to vain, profane and vain babblings, to old wives' fables, to foolish and unlearned questions, to questions about genealogies and so on. Apparently there was a lot of that type of thing going on. So when somebody asks you dumb questions, you don't have to answer it. Like, did Adam have a belly button or whatever? You know, might be an interesting thing to think about. Nothing to split hairs about and split a church over, certainly. Not that I've ever heard of a church splitting over whether Adam had a belly button or not. But anyway, foolish questions you can just avoid. So God's name is not to be blasphemed. So we've established then that blasphemy is prohibited in the New Testament. Blasphemy is taking the Lord's name in vain. And then let me just give you one more verse that tells us that God's name is not to be blasphemed or taken in vain, in other words. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 1. It says, "Let as many servants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, that the name of God and his doctrine be not blasphemed." So Paul here is saying, in this case here, it's the conduct which can blaspheme the name of the Lord. But regardless, the name of the Lord is not to be blasphemed, which means the name of the Lord is not to be taken in vain. So there you have it. We got the first three of the Ten Commandments that are repeated again in the New Testament. Next time, we will go with the fourth commandment, which is the Sabbath commandment, and we'll have some fun with that one, and then go through the rest of the Ten Commandments, and we will probably still have at least one more sermon after that, I think. So thank you for your kind and patient attention.